This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Artist Melissa Oreski combines plants and art, but not in landscape painting.
I kind of zoomed in on plants themselves and thinking about how they function and how they might be considered as beings.
Laura Kennedy has more about Oreski's exhibit, Growing Time. As marijuana becomes legal, we look back at prohibition as it began a century ago and the attitudes people held about alcohol. Some of the same feelings society has held about cannabis more recently. Meet the new Unit 5 school superintendent, and John Norton dives into the storytelling sensibilities of the band Them Cooley Boys. All that and a GLT news update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The Unit 5 school board has formally approved its choice for a new superintendent to replace the outgoing Mark Daniel. She is Dr. Kristen Kendrick-Weichel, currently superintendent of Warrensburg-Latham Schools near Decatur. It was not a unanimous vote. Board member Karen Pyle said she thought other candidates fit the district needs profile better. We caught up with Pyle shortly after the meeting to ask her to explain the vote.
The vote is done at this point. Dr. Weichel will be our new superintendent, and we want to look forward to moving forward with her, welcoming her to the district, and helping give her support.
If you're taking a vote of conscience, though, it's got to be a fairly strongly held feeling, so don't you as an elected official owe it to the public to unpack your thoughts?
I think as a board, we took in the information from the community. We certainly spent a lot of time deliberating on it, but what we need to do now is to give her support and help her to be successful in our district. You know, I have six members of the board who feel very strongly that she does meet that profile and she is the right candidate for the job, and I support them in that decision, and I want to move forward.
You denied her your support with a vote, though. Why was it important, if you knew you were going to be in the minority, to register the no vote?
Because I think that there were other candidates that more closely matched that profile, and that was also shared in some of the community feedback that we received, and so it was important to reflect that.
When a new superintendent comes in with a mixed vote, some can view that dissent as a magnet for the disaffected. Pyle says she will support Kendrick-Weichel going forward. And Board President Barry Hitchin says he does not think the result weakens Kendrick-Weichel's start.
No. Dr. Pyle voted how she felt she needed to vote, but I know Dr. Pyle has a commitment to this district and to this board, and now that the board has voted on this topic, I without a doubt can say she will support the superintendent in any way that she needs to be supported.
Does denying her support at this outset weaken Dr. Kendrick-Weichel's position as she prepares to assume the position?
No, because she's still the superintendent of the district. It doesn't matter if it was a 6-1 vote. There are districts out there that have 4-3 votes on their superintendents, and they could still be successful.
Who?
I don't have any names off the top of my head, but from discussions with our consultants, it does happen from time to time because some districts just are always 4-3 votes on everything.
Reporters also talked with Kendrick-Weichel before the meeting. She's currently in a district with fewer than 2,000 students, and Unit 5 has more than 13,000 kids.
So it's a lot easier to get to know all the students in a smaller district right away. But again, having been in a large unit district, you know, if you're in the buildings and visible in the community, you can get to know kids' faces and names, and they recognize who you are and what you're doing to help them.
There has been an ongoing and protracted issue of on-time performance for school buses and a difficulty in finding enough bus drivers to make that happen, both prior to first student handling it and with First Student. How would you tackle that problem?
Sure. So I would need to know more as far as what's been tried thus far, but I believe in, you know, developing partnerships. So I'd want to work with our local maybe community college to see how can we train more bus drivers, because it's not as simple as taking a five-hour course and then going to take a test. It involves time and really networking to, you know, consider getting people to serve as bus drivers that have never considered it but might do a really great job for our students.
Unit 5, like many districts, has been laboring under a structural deficit. The current administration has roughly framed that as if we balance the budget completely, we're going to have to lay off more than 100 teachers. There have been various methods suggested on how to deal with that. How would you deal with that?
Sure. So unfortunately, I've dealt with this in two other districts. And first and foremost, coming in, I would need to assess where are all of our assets. And assets can be things, people, materials, purchase services that we're contracting with. So I would need to get a good handle on that. And then as a group, and so that would mean staff and community members to really prioritize what are our priorities and then look at where can we make cuts. No one wants to make cuts. But unfortunately, at times, sometimes that's required.
Would you consider a tax referendum?
I think that's something that the board and community should definitely at least consider. But right now, I probably don't have enough information to be able to say, yes, we definitely would, or no, we definitely would not.
The voters of the district a few years ago turned down a sales tax referendum for infrastructure support. However, some bonding is going to be rolling off the district's debt load, freeing up property tax money should the district choose to go for a referendum. As a tactical matter, should the district go for a referendum before that roll-off and implement any resulting decision of the electorate as it rolls off, or should it let the property taxes go down and then go back up?
Would you like me to tackle that one? So I think that's something very important for us to think about. Taking into consideration how taxes will be decreasing over the next couple of years as we do roll off some of our debt, we need to have that discussion about, as the bond payments go down, does that make sense to, at that point, increase our ed fund referendum to have a net zero impact on our community?
And how do you feel about that philosophically?
Again, I don't probably have all the information right now, so I really would need to see all the information out on the table. But I think it's not uncommon for districts to take that into consideration as bonds are paid off or down. Is there another way that we can still maintain revenue to provide the same quality services for students?
It has been some years since Unit 5 engaged in a full-fledged redistricting of school boundaries. Teachers at the high schools have also complained periodically about an imbalance in numbers between the high schools. How do you approach the politically ticklish task of redistricting?
Sure. So first and foremost, I need to get in district on a full-time basis and visit the schools myself, talk with staff to see what really are the issues that they feel are most pressing before I can make any recommendations to the board with redistricting.
As a matter of philosophy, how often should that happen as opposed to the minor tweaks that happen over a more frequent period?
Sure. I think it's really based on the needs of the community. How fast has the community grown or changed since the last time redistricting has taken place? What additional buildings have been added or maybe no longer in use? And so you have to look at capacity and providing the same and equitable opportunities to all of our students, not just certain groups.
Yeah, most educators agree that mixing economic and ethnic boundaries helps students in all categories learn. How even should the partitioning be, or how even should the apportioning be, do you think?
Again, it really depends on where buildings are located and our groups of students where we're drawing from. It's hard to say at this point without having, you know, seen the exact makeup of all of our buildings and visiting with staff and community members.
How do you see the new school funding formula continuing to develop over time? It's had some effect on some districts and less effect on others. How do you think it'll affect Unit 5, and how did it affect Warrensburg-Latham?
So Warrensburg-Latham, we saw a slight increase each year since it went into effect. I think whether or not the state can maintain funding The formula as it is will really dictate, you know, what it looks like in the future.
And what are the odds of that given the pension problem?
I don't have my magic ball to know that answer right now.
What do you think makes you a great fit for Unit 5?
Sure. Developing relationships, first and foremost, is definitely a strength of mine. It's easy for me to develop those relationships and therefore share a vision with staff and community members and execute that vision and with staff and community. So it's a joint effort. You know, no one person can do the job by him or herself.
Barry, what makes this candidate the candidate?
She is incredible. She came into the interviews prepared. She was able to draw in the board members. We threw questions at her. She was able to answer every question we had. She was very personable, very energetic, and she just drew you in. And we think that's the type of energy that we need in Unit 5. She's also got an outstanding history of 23 years in education. She's been at Warrensburg Latham for longer than the typical superintendent stays in one district, so she's got longevity in past experiences. She's also got a special education background, which in my opinion is very important for Unit 5 as we continue to see growing needs of our students.
And on that front, there's been a sustained effort to raise the profile of mental health in the community and a lot of attention given both at the district level and community-wide in socio-emotional health of students in recent years. How does your special ed background equip you to navigate that going forward?
Sure. So I've always been a big believer if your social-emotional needs aren't met, it's really hard to make progress in academics. And so I think every school across the United States, we're all seeing more and more students with social-emotional needs. Therefore, we need to help our staff know what are those triggers that sometimes kids come to school with. It's not you personally as a staff member, but then when a student's triggered, how do we respond to support them in the best possible way? And then sometimes it's even looking at the social-emotional needs of our staff as well. Our jobs are tough in education, and most of us take home our students, you know, worries and struggles home with us, and so we have to take care of our staff as well as students.
Other than size, what do you perceive as the key cultural differences between the two districts, and how will you adjust to those?
I think every district actually has its own unique feel, traditions, values. And so, again, with any new position, it's just learning what's most important to the community here at Unit 5.
And what have the board members in charge of the interview process articulated to you about what's most important, since they're your immediate bosses?
I think some of the things I referenced earlier, you know, so the financial situation for many school districts is an ongoing issue. Transportation, communication, having that clear and ongoing communication will be really important as I start the new position and develop a vision with the staff and community and then communicate the progress towards that vision.
Kristen Kendrick-Weichel, the incoming Unit 5 superintendent, also has 6 children, the youngest a junior in high school, the oldest 26, and a 1-year-old granddaughter. She says she likes reading mysteries and inspirational stories. Kendrick-Weichel will be paid $185,000 a year. She replaces Mark Daniel, who leaves at the end of June.
Support for WGLT comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The CPB's Community Service Grant helps WGLT bring you Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and more programming on which you depend for news, information, and entertainment. Additional support comes from WGLT listeners. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, a green and growing approach to art. 2 weeks ago, cannabis became legal in Illinois. 100 years ago, we were going in the other direction. The ban on alcohol was just going into effect nationwide, a prohibition that would last 13 years and famously fail. Candace Summers from the McLean County Museum of History will deliver an illustrated presentation Thursday night about prohibition in McLean County. Ryan Denham speaks to Summers about the parallels between the two prohibitions, starting with how people here reacted to alcohol being made illegally a century ago.
Like pretty much everybody else did in the entire nation, where you, of course, had people who supported temperance and prohibition cheered that they had won this great battle and that our lives were going to get better because there was no more demon rum and alcohol ruining people's lives, especially women and children. And then, of course, you had people that were not fans of prohibition and temperance and are like, all right, how am I going to get through this? And they got through it by stockpiling in that whole year this country had to stockpile before prohibition became the law of the land. And then, of course, you had the enterprising individuals who decided to produce it illegally and sell it and transport it. You can look at McLean County as kind of like a little microcosm to what was going on in the bigger cities.
How much of that was going on? How much bootlegging and rum running did we have going on here?
There's quite a bit. So one source that I used, because this all came about when I was a grad student in the history department here at ISU, and I took a class on local history. And so the project was you had to pick a local history project. Here at ISU is the Illinois Regional Archives Depository for this region, and they have the McLean County Jail Register. And that lists every single person that was ever put in that jail. It definitely had prohibition, those time frames, 1920 to 1933, in its pages. And so I just page after page after page of person who either made it, sold it, transported it. I also included prostitution and gambling in with this because a lot of times those go hand in hand, although prostitution and gambling, there had been issues with that before prohibition and, of course, after prohibition. But you could see, you know, a lot of individuals, and they would put all their details, you know, where they were born, where they were from, their occupation, and then, of course, the crime they were convicted of, whether it was violating the 18th Amendment prohibition, or it might have been some local ordinance or variation of that they violated, but all dealt with alcohol. And it wasn't just Bloomington Normal and McLean County, all over the state. Peoria especially, you would get some interesting stories that came out of Peoria. I mean, they were huge in the whiskey-making business before Prohibition. And there were stories of when Prohibition was enacted, they just dumped it all in the river. And people to this day, when there's a drought and the banks are low enough, you can go and find all these bottles all along the river. And so there was a lot of hooch coming from Peoria over to McLean County. There was a lot coming up from St. Louis, down from Chicago. It was flowing like water.
So oddly enough, Bloomington has something of a speakeasy again now.
Yes.
There's this place called Bakery and Pickle,
yes,
which is part of Epiphany Farms that opened up in downtown Bloomington. It even has like a little hidden entrance.
Yeah.
Were there any notable or famous speakeasies or booze-serving establishments in McLean County during Prohibition?
There were. And so years ago, before I was at the museum, it was in the mid-1990s, they had an exhibit about the flapper and the Roaring Twenties. And they interviewed a couple people who were around during Prohibition and asked them, like, where were the hot spots? Where could you go get all this hooch? So there was the Rocket Club on the corner of Henshaw and Forest, Six Points Road Speakeasy, the African American Bar, the Royal Palm Social Club on West Washington Street, and the Nighthawk on Lumber Street. Those are just a few of the names associated with some of the speakeasies in town. And then, of course, you had, you know, people at their own private residences had them as well. And then this one gentleman that they interviewed, his name was Maurice Irving. He was a soda delivery person. And so what better way to hide the alcohol that you were making and selling but by adding a nice flavor to it? And so he was the supplier of many of these names of places that you could go wet your whistle, so to speak, because he knew it. He was delivering soda to these places. And he also knew where quite a few of the houses of ill fame were on the noted red light district here in Bloomington, which was called the Line, because a lot of them followed the railroad tracks in Bloomington, because he would deliver soda to the madams who ran the houses so they could mix it, you know, with the illegal alcohol they had there as well. So it really was. This was anything but a dry town during Prohibition.
There was not the rise of organized crime here as there were in other parts of this country during Prohibition, 1920 to 1933. Even without those, did we still have any episodes of violence related to Prohibition?
A man came in the museum wanting to learn information about his great-great-uncle. And he said his great-great-uncle was a bootlegger and was murdered. And so, of course, I write down the name because I want to know more myself. And I'm looking at newspapers.com, and I actually find the story and give it to this man where well-known bootlegger in town. He had a rap sheet a mile long, and I guess he decided he wanted to get out of the bootlegging business. And shortly before he did, another man came to buy some alcohol off him, and he turned him away. So this man that the pantograph at the time called a Mexican shot the bootlegger and then killed himself. So it was a murder-suicide, made the papers, and the bootlegger himself is buried at Park Hill Cemetery. So there were some instances of violence. Of course, there's also stories of, you know, poison liquor because it's made in bathtubs at home under maybe some questionable conditions or using questionable materials. I mean, you can look at it the same way today with some of the drugs that people get where they're, you know, lacing it with other things, you know, maybe lacing the alcohol with, you know, antifreeze or turpentine or other chemicals they can get their hands on.
Well,
in
the government itself, didn't the government itself poison industrial alcohol during this time to deter it from being used in alcohol settings?
That sounds about right. That sounds about right.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. I'm speaking with Candace Summers, Director of Education at the McLean County Museum of History. She's doing an illustrated program at 7 p.m. Thursday, January 16th at the Bloomington Public Library about the history of Prohibition in McLean County. So, Candace, what about the town of Normal? How does that town's kind of famously sober history intersect with national Prohibition?
So, town of Normal, founded dry, 1865. I mean, Jesse Fell was a Quaker and very much a temperance supporter in the utmost degree. And so that town was dry, you know, until the 70s. But it doesn't mean people didn't go to Bloomington to either wet their whistle or bring it back home. I found reference to a certain streetcar that went from Bloomington to Normal that was very well known that people would on Friday nights ride over to Bloomington to get their alcohol and then ride back to Normal to bring it home.
Not too dissimilar from the flow of college students from Normal to Bloomington.
It's very true. There are very, very similar things even to this day. People'd go over to Bloomington, they'd get what they want, then they'd come home, or, you know, they'd, like I said, drive over to Bloomington, ride over to Bloomington and bring it back. And even, you know, even when Prohibition was law of the land, there were bootleggers in Normal. I found more in Bloomington than anything, but there were some instances that I did find, you know, people doing the same things, making it, selling it in Normal as well.
And Normal stayed dry technically until pretty late, right? 1973?
So in 1933, when Prohibition ended, they were dry for, I think, about 13 months. And then they voted to go back to their dry ways.
Yeah, that was probably a timing thing, right? If Prohibition goes into effect and then you have to vote again to...
Yeah, absolutely right. So they had to form their own ordinances. So on December 5th, 1933, the town of Normal was wet until residents voted 2-1 to go dry again on March 4th, 1935. And the museum actually has a really cool document where it was a petition where all the residents signed, even children ages 6 years and older, wanting Normal to go back to being dry. So that was something the citizens there at the time really felt strongly about, is they did not want alcohol in their town. But again, it's a piece of paper, so who knows what was still happening after they signed it to go back to being dry again.
So as we talk here today in McLean County and the rest of Illinois, we just ended another prohibition that has been around for quite a while for cannabis. Cannabis became legal on January 1st. Dispensaries are now popping up all over Illinois. So when you look at these two prohibitions, you know, alcohol and cannabis, and how they both ended ultimately, do you see any parallels there between the two?
Again, even though something is outlawed, people are still going to do it. And so, you know, now that it has been legalized, I know a lot of people fear that it's just the floodgates are going to open and people are just, all people everywhere are just going to go out there and be high all the time. And the same fear was if alcohol is legal, everyone is going to drink it. Everybody's, all these men are going to be drunk. They're going to be going home, abusing their wives and children. They're not going to have enough money to support their families. And that's not the truth. You know, if somebody wants to do it, they're going to do it, regardless of if there is a law in place that says they can or can't. And I think if it's regulated well, just like alcohol is regulated, you know, cannabis is now regulated, that will help people, you know, hopefully maintain that moderation. Because prohibition, it wasn't always just a total ban on alcohol. It began as alcohol in moderation with the temperance movement. It was only the extreme group, the prohibitionists, that said, no, we want it all gone all the time. And so you can kind of see a parallel with, you know, people's view on drugs. It's like, you know, in moderation, but then you have the extreme where, nope, it's all gone. It's all bad.
Candace Summers from the McLean County Museum of History. On Thursday night, you were going to be delivering this illustrated program going over the prohibition in McLean County. What do you want people to walk away thinking about and feeling about this period of time on Thursday night as you wrap things up?
I want them to understand the time period, to understand where people were coming from, that, you know, in a lot of ways, it was a minority voice that had a very loud voice that carried and had a lot of influence, and that it wasn't necessarily a bad voice because it helped organizations form that taught people about alcohol and being responsible. I also want people to understand that, again, if you tell somebody not to do something, it doesn't necessarily mean they're not going to do it. Because in my opinion, telling somebody you can't have alcohol, telling somebody you can't, you know, smoke marijuana, sometimes makes it more appealing to people. And so it makes it kind of taboo and makes it more interesting. And so if I can go down to the shady nook and I can get, you know, a glass of wine or even a gin and tonic, you know, it kind of gives me a thrill as well. And it kind of makes me feel like, oh, I have this free choice and I'm doing this against the, you know, people telling me not to do it. So people can appreciate and understand, you know, what the mindset of people were back then.
It's Candace Summers, Director of Education at the McLean County Museum of History. She's doing an illustrated program at 7 p.m. Thursday, January 16th, at the Bloomington Public Library about the history of prohibition in McLean County. I'm Ryan Denham.
If you like local histories like this one, you can subscribe to our McHistory podcast at WGLT.org.
Support for WGLT comes from the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts, presenting The Drifters on Saturday, January 18th at 7:30. Famous for hits such as Stand By Me, you'll have the opportunity to celebrate their number one singles. Tickets at artsblooming.org. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, the storytelling of the musical group Them Cooley Boys. In the depths of dreary winter, one local artist is showcasing her work inspired by nature. Melissa Oreski creates her paintings and collage works in sync with the life cycle of plants. An exhibition of her latest work opens this weekend in downtown Bloomington. WGLT Arts correspondent Laura Kennedy has more.
The McLean County Arts Center in Bloomington presents Growing Time, a collection of works by artist Melissa Oreski. Working in paint and collage, Oreski's art follows the processes of plants. She says she can trace the roots of her current creations back to her childhood and the wildflower hunts she would go on with her mother, who was studying to be a botanist.
And I think I've sort of been oriented towards plants ever since then. Until about 5 years ago, I had made work about landscape more broadly, but then I kind of zoomed in on plants themselves and thinking about how they function and how they might be considered as beings.
How do you express that through what I see mostly is sort of painting and collage work.
Mm-hmm.
How do you express that through your creations?
I think a lot of painting and drawing starts with observation. And even though I'm really an abstract painter, and if you look at my work, that's probably what you would think the pieces were upon first glance, the abstraction actually comes from spending a long time observing. So in order to try and think about plants, I think the thing that compels me is actually just looking at them. And as someone who's spent a fair amount of time gardening and weeding and getting my hands dirty and being involved with materials outside, that's another thing that brings me into the realm of plant-likeness, is all of the materials in the studio have a relationship to materials I encounter in the world.
Well, let's get specific about the materials that you're using to create these works. And you'll forgive me, looking at some of the pieces that you have incorporated into your works, I swear some of it looks like carpeting.
It is.
Oh!
It is. I have this sort of anything goes rule with materials.
Well, that's fun.
Yeah, if I can glue it down, I can use it. If I can get it to work as part of an image, then it's fair game.
Are you drawn to any type of materials in particular?
I'm drawn to things that have a sort of ability to slip into feeling like something else. Well, one of the things that is a really nice metaphor between plants and paintings or collages is this idea of sheaths or skeins or sort of flat pieces of paper being kind of like leaves, so surface area, how things fold, whether they are stout with moisture, or whether they feel slick, or whether they feel kind of dry and are brittle a little bit. So all of those qualities of the different materials I use point to the different material qualities you would notice outside of painting.
Does it matter to you when somebody is observing your art that they see exactly what you had in your mind's eye when you were creating it? For example, I'm looking at this here, and I'm seeing the shapes that kind of look like they look like droplets, but they also look like leaves, and with the blue and stuff, I tend to get more of an idea of moisture and of droplets, like something in the rain. Would that bother you at all if I see something that you didn't create it that way in your mind?
I think that what you're thinking about probably did cross my mind while I was making it at some
point. That's good.
I mean, I don't remember everything I thought about while I was making it, but those thoughts are completely appropriate. So I think that there's a sort of expansiveness to how they can be considered. A lot as a teacher, we're always asking students to be really specific, to be as specific as possible. And while I practice that in my work, there's always some kind of particular impulse that generated the artwork and some kind of set of ideas that's very particular to it. I also want those ideas to accumulate and multiply as they're made, and so they connect to other things. So the idea that you would think about droplets or water, there's a lot of liquid things happening in this piece. There's a lot of things that are gesturing, and that's actually one of the things I like to consider about plants and the forms of plants, is that they have the capacity to gesture. And if you're keyed into them, you might have a sense of why one plant leaves are kind of hanging a certain way and how that connects to what it's doing. So all of the things that you might think about as a person relating to that gesture could connect to something relevant about that plant.
Well, plants have their own timetable and they grow and they change in their own way. How about your works? How long does it take you to create one? Do you really just take your time and let it tell you what it wants? Do you ever have to force it as one would force a bulb? How does it work for you?
Yeah, that's a really good point. I do force them sometimes, and they take different periods of time. Some of them are super fast, and I guess fast, the scale and the material, like whether it's a drawing or a collage or drawing or a painting, does make a difference. The drawings tend to go faster. They tend to go faster if they're smaller. There's just less that you can do to it before it gets too full. But they also can take very different amounts of time. So some of them I worked on for maybe a month or two. Some of them I worked on for like a week, ignored it because I didn't know what to do to it for the next 6 months, and then came back to it. So they kind of go into hibernation a little bit. Some of them I work on really consistently and get very obsessive over. Maybe I push them to the point of being overworked and they kind of need to get reworked or
pruned.
Yes, pruned, weeded. Each one has its own process and each one can have a different amount of time embedded in it. I tend to overfill things. I'm one of those people who has a little bit of a fear of empty space. Yes. So,
speaking of overfilling, let's go take a look down here at this one in particular caught my eye. It's just loads of fun. Does this one have a title?
These all have the same versions of the same title. The small 18 by 24 paintings are titled Vegetal Entities, which is kind of silly, but they're kind of like plant portraits. They're like individuals. I'm thinking of them as sort of one creature or one entity. None of them are actually specific plants, although I will get shape ideas or the sorts of gesturing ideas that I was talking about before from particular plants.
And you do go big.
Yeah.
When you do create some of your creations. And we've got one that's quite colorful, and then next to it is another that explores realms of gray. Almost looks like that was painted onto celluloid, but I know that's actually torn out of a book, of paper torn out of a book, but it makes it look like they're painted onto celluloid film.
Yeah, the edges of the pad.
Yeah,
so this one is kind of unique in the show. I started it on a small piece of paper, and as I filled that piece of paper, I glued another piece of paper onto it, and so on and so forth, until it grew to be fairly large. It is a little bit unwieldy. I felt like if I kept growing it, it was going to be structurally unstable, which is why I stopped where I did. But this one is especially built and worked, and my idea for it was that it would have both the grid structure, that sort of wonky organic grid structure of how the pieces of paper were seamed together as part of the image, but then also, and so those are like little plots that keep getting added on. And then these forms keep growing and filling that space as it expands, and then growing over each other. So this thing has gone through many, many, many stages. There's a lot of different materials in it, like iridescent reflective vinyl that I like to get from craft stores. And then there's calligraphy paper I brought back after a trip teaching in China. And then there's pieces of just regular drawing paper, stuff that I found.
What about the color palette? You know, next to this other one with lots of color, this one has a very serious look to it.
Uh-huh. I'm actually very color obsessive, and every once in a while, I sort of need a break from it, and I kind of want to purge color from a piece. But one of the things that always happens is when I remove a lot of color, I start to notice all of these really subtle variations of color. So this is mostly black, white, and gray, but there are a lot of blacks and a lot of grays and a lot of whites, and there's some yellows. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of sort of warm and cool and subtle things that you might not notice if there were a lot of other colors happening.
Well, how do you hope viewers, when they come in to see Growing Time, how do you hope they react to this collection, Melissa?
I hope that they want to spend time with it. I think that, you know, it's appropriate. I've spent a lot of time working on it. I like making work that people could stand in front of and that would change as they looked at it, that they would become aware of a lot of different spaces opening up, different forms or different sorts of associations emerging from it, that it would still feel to them like they were looking at a landscape, looking at the ground, paying attention to a plant, but then noticing all kinds of different things about it the same way I do when I'm outside.
That's artist Melissa Oreski. Growing Time is up at the McLean County Arts Center in Bloomington through February 14th. I'm Laura Kennedy.
You can hear more from Melissa Oreski, plus see photos from her exhibit at WGLT.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
Them Cooley Boys frontman Soren Staff wanted the Eau Claire, Wisconsin-based band's third album to hang together thematically. Like many bands, their first album was everything they'd written before forming. Their second, mainly leftovers. Ahead of their show tomorrow night at the Castle Theater, Staff tells WGLT's John Norton the songs on the new album were written around the same time, with lyrics and sonic ideas that lent themselves to telling a single story.
We have always listened to albums all the way through. You know, I mean, a lot of people don't do that these days, but, you know, that was important to us that if you sat down and listened to this record, it was going to be an experience and it was all going to come together thematically. So,
well, and you mentioned the sonic quality of the album. You're known as sort of a folk bluegrass, maybe a kind of a newer age folk bluegrass with some rock elements in there.
Did you step inside my head for a minute?
For a genre of music known for foot stomping rock and roll, you know, it's a fairly subdued album, at least as it starts off.
Well, the record before that literally starts with stomps and claps. We knew that we could get to that point on this record, but we didn't necessarily want to give it to people right away. You know, we've always been a band that has really strived to be very dynamic, almost like cinematic in what we do. Like, you build stuff up and tear it down. And that was kind of the thought process behind Pray You Don't Get Lonely being the first one, because, you know, it starts off so very sparse and contemplative. And then lyrically, it's kind of asking you in, kind of inviting you to listen to the record, and then once the whole band comes in, it's full and happy, and we just thought the dynamic change sonically and lyrically presented itself that way really well.
Since you wanted this to hang together thematically, I'm going to go toward the end of the album now instead of going to the next couple of songs. But Hand of God, parts 2 and 3. Boy, that certainly hints at some bluegrass and folk, but for the most part, it's just a glorious rock song. It's like an anthem.
Maybe the hand of God hangs out in baseball parks, watching the long balls fall into the neighbor's yard.
Why did you sequence this as the second to last song on this 11-song album?
We kind of saw it as something that was going to, like, give an end to the story that we were trying to tell. Earlier in the record, there's the Hand of God Part 1 that leads into another song called Only One. Hand of God Part 1, like, introduces this, like, musical theme that we play on the piano. And then these three chords that we play at certain times during the record. We play this, it's like a D, F sharp, minor and a G, and then we play those like in three different songs, like in sequence. So we wanted to introduce this theme at the beginning of the record to kind of like show that, hey, we're gonna tell a story here and this all is connected. So then if you listened all the way through, then when that theme came back in at the end of that song, because part 3 of that song, that theme gets reintroduced again. And we kind of wanted people to hear that and go, oh, so that's what was going on here. Hand of God Part 2 and 3 was one of the first, I think, in the session, that was one of the first few songs that I had an idea about, but it was one of the last songs that we actually finished. It was something we always were thinking about, to kind of like tell a whole story with this record. It just came to fruition later in the game than the rest of the songs. But yeah, that's our favorite song to play live on the record.
Maybe the hand of God doesn't do a lot, but when he does, you thank the Lord. You can find salvation in a parking lot or in an old
filled with alcoholic farmers coming nightly in controls. Yeah, I think from the stadium.
Hand of God, Parts 2 and 3 is the name of the song on WGLT Sound Ideas. The name of the album is Die Happy. It's from them Cooley Boys. Soren Staff from the band is with us. Well, let's talk about Sonics. You're sort of known as a band who's got some bluegrass and folk background, but unlike Trampled by Turtles and The Way Down Wanderers out of Peoria, maybe even Good Morning Bedlam out of Minneapolis, you know, they're definitely, you can hear that bluegrass, you can hear that folk. With them Cooley Boys, it's more of a hinting at some of that. It's more of a rock and pop album as much as it is with any folk elements.
Well, that's always been important to us. You know, I mean, we started at a certain place. It used to just be me on acoustic guitar, our bow on banjo, and my little brother Jens on mandolin. And through the years, we added bass, we added drums. We didn't necessarily grow up in the tradition of bluegrass or folk. It was something that we kind of discovered and co-opted on ourselves. And I think that gives us a little bit of a, you're grounded in what you came from, but you're not restrained by it in any way. We're really excited to be doing different sounds, different song structures.
At your midnight manifestos, while the rest of us sleep, they'll be gone before the morning. Midnight lovers tend to be.
We love where we came from, and we love that folk and bluegrass background, but we're not constrained by it, and that's a bit freeing, you know. Once you realize that you don't have to sound a certain way, it's really fun to just get in that space and create.
Well, let's talk a little bit about where you are from, which is interesting. I mentioned those bands just a minute ago, Trampled by Turtles, and by the way, Dave Simonette from that band, who we talked with last year, produced this new album called Die Happy, but they're out of Duluth, Minnesota. It's almost in Canada. Good Morning Bedlam, another band we've had around here and we've talked to. They're out of Minneapolis. You are out of Eau Claire, Wisconsin. That's not too far from Canada either. And
right, yeah.
Even around here, you know, we're the Way Down Wanderers out of Peoria. All three of those bands have that folk bluegrassy kind of sound, but none of you guys are from Carolina, Virginia. What's in the waters up north where this sound now is really becoming popular?
I think the internet plays a little bit into that. You know, you don't have to grow up in a certain place anymore to be exposed to something. When I think of this, the genres that we play, including what Trample plays and, you know, what Good Morning Bedlam plays, it comes from a space of sincerity and genuineness. Like, regardless of the actual sound coming out, like the themes there are, I would say, Midwestern values, you know. You're going to be straightforward in what you say and be genuine about it. And I think that bleeds through a lot of what we do and a lot of what the music coming out of the Midwest is sounding like these days, just because that's what's important to the people here.
And I thought I heard you say
you're based out of Eau Claire. Is that a long-term thing for you, or are you going to have to go somewhere else if you guys really want to take this as far as it'll let you go?
The funny thing is, we actually relocated to Eau Claire because we're all from really small towns in Wisconsin, and Eau Claire has kind of set itself up as this kind of music city to a little point. It's not the size of Minneapolis. It's not the size of Chicago, but the music they make here has been getting national and worldwide attention. I mean, it's the hometown of Bon Iver, but they have wonderful festivals, wonderful venues. It's a town that cares about music, and that's all you really need to have if you're trying to be a band in a town. You know, these days it's not about having some gigantic city that can give you the right press. It's about having people that are excited to come listen to you and are going to tell people around the other places. So we use Eau Claire as this home base because we know 3-4 times a year we can have the time of our lives playing a couple shows here, and then we go and go to other places and build it that way too. So we're just happy to be in Eau Claire, and I think it's a place we're going to stay.
Soren Staff of Them Cooley Boys speaking with WGLT's John Norton. Them Cooley Boys and Fireside Collective play the Castle Theater.
tonight. You can hear songs from Them Cooley Boys album on Highway 309, available 24/7 at WGLT.org. Discover local music and hear from artists playing in Central Illinois on the GLT Music Podcast. Find it on NPR One or your favorite podcast app. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories, which today came from Ryan Denham, Laura Kennedy, and John Norton. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Let's go out with Them Cooley Boys. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.